Good morning. I'd like to call the Property Tax Division to order. We're starting a few minutes late because duplicating has been very busy this morning, along with members. And the schedule for today, after we approve the minutes, is we're going to start in on the amendments. But first, I would like a motion to approve the minutes of March 29th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bang Moos. Approval of the minutes of March 29th. Any concerns? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? The minutes are adopted. And the order that we're going to take things in is after the author's amendment, we're going to hear the submitted amendments first, and then we're not going to take up testimony amendments. That's what we did on Friday. And after we've gone through all the amendments, if there's an interest in discussing the bill further, we can do that. And then we'll vote out our bill as the division report that we have all contributed to. And I appreciate everyone's contributions to putting this together. And so first I'll move that the committee adopt House File 2348 as amended and that it be referred to the Committee on Taxes to bring it before us. And then I'd like to move the A21, the author's amendment. And I do have a small oral amendment from staff to that, but I'll make sure that everyone gets out the A21 first. And I'll find my note from Pat in the blizzard. Maybe I'll have Ms. Dalton, would you like to read the oral amendment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the oral amendment is on page 8, line 24. Delete the word binding and insert bonding.
Everyone got that? A simple technical correction. And with that, I'll ask our House Research to walk us through the amendment. It's a little longer than some of them that we'll be considering today.
Madam Chair and members, the first three lines of the amendment, 1.3 through 1.5, extend the deadline for applying for the exemption in this section. The application deadline for this exemption has already passed for the year, so in order to make this section effective for 2019, that deadline just needs to be extended for applications in this year only. Lines 1.6 through 1.7 of the amendment allow a county veteran service officer to certify applications for the disabled veterans exclusion for the applications that are received after the current application deadline, but up into the new application deadline as outlined in the division report. Lines 1.8 through 1.10 clarify the section effective date for the senior deferral program. The current language references property tax assessment years when this amendment would just change that to reference the applications rather than the assessment year. Lines 1.11 through 1.12 clarify the remaining portion of an ag preserve can still remain an ag preserve after the changes made by the division report, even if the total acreage falls below 40 acres. Lines 1.13, it just deletes duplicate language for the Melrose Fire Remediation Grants. This language was in Article 1 and Article 2. This amendment just removes the language from Article 1. The language can instead be found in Article 2. Line 1.14 adds recommended values to the types of valuation that must be included in the state assessed property report. This portion of the amendment, along with the next few that deal with the state assessed report, came from recommendations from the Department of Revenue. So 1.15 shortens the number of years of data the report must include, and this had to deal with some retention policies with the department and concerns over the data that they would have available. Lines 1.16 through 1.22 address some more concerns that clarify the valuation data that must be included in the state assessed property report. Lines 2.1 through 2.2 clarify information related to the administrative appeal process that must be included in the state assessed property report. And then finally, line 2.3 moves back the due date of that state assessed property report from January 15th to February 1st.
Madam Chair, I'll cover the rest of the author's amendment. Lines 2.4 to 2.6 provide the City of Scanlon with an extra $40,000 a year for 10 years and LGA, instead of allowing them to have a sales tax, to raise $400,000. Their sales tax is repealed later on in the amendment. Lines 2.7 to 2.10 make just technical changes to the language, general local sales tax language suggested by the Department of Revenue. Line 2.11 eliminates the paragraph related to cities that received reduced local sales tax authority that was lower than their original resolution and referendum, and that's because of the vast majority of the rest of this amendment. Page 2, line 12 through page 13.14 removes the modified local sales tax provisions for the cities of Duluth, Two Harbors, Avon, Blue Earth, Cambridge, Elk River, Glenwood, and International Falls, and replaces them with their original bill language. However, for many of them, any of the cities whose list of projects was vague and or did not include a cost for each specific project, they are now going to be required to pass a new, more detailed resolution, which I'll talk about at the very end of the amendment. Lines 13.15 through page 14.22 removes the Scanlon sales tax provision, which was replaced with the LGA, and for Sauk Center replaces the reduced local sales tax authority with the full $10 million in the original bill, but after discussions with the author, it's been rewritten to explicitly limit the spending to infrastructure directly related to the trunk Highway 71 reconstruction. Pages 14.23 through 17.31 removes the modified local sales tax provisions for the City of Wilmer and Worthington and replaces them with their original bill language. Wilmer had the detailed list of projects, so they will not be subject to Section 32, but Worthington will. And then page 18.1 through 18.31 is the new Section 32, and this requires all cities granted local sales tax authority in this bill that funded more than one project, and either the project list was vague and or the dollar amounts were not assigned to individual projects, they must now pass a new city resolution before they may impose the tax. The resolution must detail each project to be funded and the amount of revenue allocated to each project. They must submit their resolution to the Commissioner of Revenue, who must certify that the resolution meets the requirement of this section before the tax may be imposed, and the city must post the resolution on the city's website for the duration of the tax. And that is the author's amendment.
Thank you so much, Ms. Dalton. Questions on and discussion on the A21 author's amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. A21 is adopted. And then we'll begin with the submitted amendments. First, the A19, which is a Petersburg Marquardt amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This really is an amendment that combines House File 204 and 205, which Representative Detmer has worked extensively with county assessors and others to get as much peace in the valley as we could in order to really increase the benefit of disabled veterans to have their tax exemption for property tax extended to their widows or widowers. And the current statute says that the limit will be up to eight years. And this bill actually does two things. One, it eliminates that 8-year statute so that they will get it until they sell the property or until their estate sells the property or they die, as one. And the other part of it is if they should sell the house and buy another property that's the same value or less value, that will extend it to that. And that's as simple as it is. And I will give Chair Marquardt an opportunity to further comment.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Petersburg, for bringing this forward, and also Representative Detmert, who's worked a lot on this. You know, we've kind of struggled with this issue for the 10, 11 years that this portion of law has been in place, and it's the right thing to do. And you know, at the time when we did the bill, which allowed veterans with 100% disability the $300,000 exemption, and those with 70% disability up to $150,000, we did include, you know, surviving spouses, but I think at that time it was just like for a year or two, and we've kind of extended it over a period of time. But I think this remedies this situation. It provides the benefits that I think are deserved and due, and so it's the right thing to do, and so I'd ask, along with Representative Petersburg, for members to approve the amendment.
Thank you. And just for the record, I want people to know that until late Thursday night, no one had ever talked to me about this issue, and you know that we had more bills referred to our committee than you could possibly hear, particularly since we had to hear all the bills that were in the vetoed bill last year that were non-controversial. And so we decided this year we'd focus on the state budget bills and the local bills and deal with classifications and administration next year. And I did not hear from a single veterans group or anyone before the end of last week. So it wasn't an intentional slight not sure. to give it a hearing. It was just I wasn't aware that anyone was hitting a deadline. Representative Barnardi.
Madam Chair, do you know what the bill number that was?
204 and 205.
House File 204 and House File 205.
That's right.
Any further discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A19 amendment is adopted. And next we have the A22 amendment from Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as you may recall, this is the Bloomington Central Station Tax Increment Finance bill. This, just to kind of paint a picture for you all, this is the 50-acre site just east of the Mall of America. This is the former controlled data site, pretty much parking lot, vacant land at this point, blighted land at this point. The city of Bloomington has spent many years planning for redevelopments. McGough Construction has been through a series of developments, working hard in redeveloping this area. The Blue Line runs through this area as well, so it's prime for high-density developments, transit-orientated developments. And the vision here is to create a community, both with as an employment center, but also for housing as well. As we kind of mentioned in our earlier conversations, again, this is simply going from extending the five-year rule out an additional 10 years, just, you know, to allow for this development momentum to continue. Currently, I've shown a positive track record with new projects that have already come online, new projects that are coming online, and others that are in the preliminary design stage. So this work does continue, and we are working towards achieving the full vision of the South Loop redevelopment area. So that being the background, and again, the bill, what the bill does is simply go from extends the five-year rule for an additional 10 years. So that is my amendment.
Okay.
Oh, and I should also, sorry, Madam Chair, draw your attention to, we have a letter of support from the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters too, in support of the project. Or in support of the bill.
Any questions or discussion from members? Seeing none, all in favor of the A22 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A22 is adopted. The next amendment we had submitted is from Representative Drazkowski, the A14. Please tell us about your proposal.
I'm still looking for my amendment, Madam Chair.
We've got a lot of paper. We don't have to rush. Thank you.
So this is one of the, my amendments from the public finance section of the bill, I believe.
Let's do it with light rail.
Okay, thank you. This is the light rail one. So, members, this amendment would take out the change that is in the bill that lessens the specificity with which we limit the ability of the Metropolitan Council to use their bonding authority. And we did this in 2017, and apparently they have come back and wanted to have the more expansive bonding authority again. So that's what the amendment does. I haven't heard from them as to why what we have in law now doesn't work, but that's the amendment, Madam Chair.
Questions and comments from members? I'm wondering if we could have House Research explain exactly what this does in terms of the impact that it might have. My understanding was that the change in the underlying bill is a technical amendment that doesn't change anything related to 2017 but makes it is clarifying language. But Mr. Clement.
Madam Chair, members, what the amendment would do is it would take out Section 6 of the public finance article. And what that amendment, or what that article of the division report currently does, is it removes what is a current law, what is a broad prohibition against the Met Council from using their bonding authority under that section to pay for certain light rail projects, and instead it narrows the ability of the Met Council to use their bonding authority, or to restrict their bonding authority, only to those projects related to the 2017 bonding authority that was granted to them at that time. What happens with the current language right now is that there are other forms of bonding that are authorized under that section of law, one of which is the authority to issue typically short-term bonds, which are called GANs. And those are bonds that that the Met Council would use, or any municipality could use, to smooth out the uneven disbursements that can happen when authority is receiving federal grants for a particular project. And so, what happened in 2017 is that the language was not specific to the 2017 language, and so the language then ended up restricting the Met Council's ability to use currently existing bonding authority that it had under that section to do those short-term bonds. That's what that particular section in the article does. There may be other people here who could testify to the exact situation in 2017. But
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Klayman. So the original language, the way it is, those GANs, bonds, and others, are they strictly for light rail, or are they for other capital projects alone, separately, I mean?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I think those bonds could be used for any project in a scenario where you're getting federal funding. My presumption would be is that the intent would be to use those for the light rail project, which is eligible to receive a federal grant. And right now, the Met Council can't do those short-term GANs bonds because of the current language that's in law right now. Although, you know, they could pursue I believe they could pursue other financing possibilities, but at a higher cost.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, you know, and I that may be at least my interpretation of the 2017 bill was that it was intended to curtail continuation of the light rail system through the bonding program through what the state was sponsored from. So with this section in it, it would then expand back to prior to that bill for anything moving forward. And so there is a it's more than a technical change. It does change kind of the philosophy that's what's there. So for whatever it's worth, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Klayman, I could you refresh my memory of the difference between the GANs and the Certificates of Participation, the COPs?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, the biggest change or the biggest difference that I'm aware of is just that the Certificates of Participation, which is what the Met Council would have to use at present to secure their short-term financing, they would have a higher interest rate, so there'd be a higher cost for those bonds, whereas the GANs bonds, you know, I believe would have a lower cost.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So members, this conversation had to do with the expansion of Southwest Light Rail in 2017, before Hennepin County had decided to disband from CTIB, the County Transit Investment Board, and in doing so, having made the decision to leave the County Transit Investment Board, they chose to raise the local option countywide tax by 0.5% to raise the revenue to service the debt on the expansion of light rail. That was principally, I mean, it was argued that it was for transportation regionally, but this was an attempt to circumvent the legislature's will with regard to expansion of Southwest Light Rail and other rail projects. So it was promised to the members of the Transportation Committee that the bonding authority that was granted originally was restricted to expanding bus rapid transit and the bus fleet, and that was something that the legislature supported. And so that was the authority was limited to bonding for buses and bus transit and not for light rail. So this so-called technical amendment in the A32 amendment, the author's amendment, would undo that and not only give bonding authority to expand the light rail, but the CTIB dissolution has already occurred, so they're moving forward with or without the legislature. Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if Mr. Clemens could clarify then how the prohibition established in 2017 law, what it still affects. Maybe we could try it that way and hopefully it'll be clearer.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, so under Section 6 language that's currently in the bill, what that would do is it would limit the prohibition to using the bonding authority that was granted in 2017 under Subdivision 1U from being used to finance those light rail projects, but it would not affect the general authority that the Met Council has under that section of law to issue the GANs bonds.
Representative Runbeck.
I mean, I like that language in six. Frankly, I think it makes, but Madam Chair, so clarify again, the prohibition was to only be in effect for what projects?
Mr. Clement.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, this Section 6, so it's Subdivision 6 of the chapter where the Met Council's bonding authority is, that was enacted in 2017 at the same time that the legislature provided bonding authority to the Met Council, but to issue debt under, I believe that's their general bonding authority. But that further authorization in 2017 was then by Subdivision 6, that was restricted so that it couldn't be used for project development, land acquisition, et cetera, to finance a light rail line. Because of how that was drafted on line 96.3, the stricken language under this section, that made this particular subdivision apply generally to all the other authority that the light rail had or that the Met Council had to do their bonding, and that included the short-term bonds. Mm-hmm. And so what Section 6 does on line 96.4 is that what it says is that this limitation only applies to the 2017 bonding authority that the legislature granted to the Met Council and doesn't apply to the general bonding authority in that section, that or to the bonding authority in that section related to the GANS bonds that then applies up until 2017 and the subdivision came in, applied just generally for the Met Council, if that explains. So in other words, Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, there are really two different types of bonding authority in that chapter, in that section right now, and one of them are these unique provisions for every year, and then the other one is this short-term bond authority that then isn't limited to a year and applies just sort of more globally for the Met Council.
Representative
Runbeck. Madam Chair, we're expanding or we're allowing GANS type bonding to be used for Southwest.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, yes, that's correct. That's what Section 6 does.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So listening to the conversation and how I understand this amendment, I can't support it. If we're going to provide further restrictions or keep those restrictions in place as a possible funding source for the Met Council to provide for light rail, I mean, I just got done describing how the blue line going through Bloomington has been such an asset to our community. Why would I want to restrict that to other communities around the state? So I can't support this bill. Light rail is a critical part of our transportation system, and bonding is a tool in which to further expand that.
I have one comment.
Representative Hewitt.
And Madam Chair, if I understand this right, to staff, that the grants that would be available if our bill goes through would be to make it more affordable or more cost-effective money for the light rail project. Is that right?
Mr. Clement.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, I believe the grants are already lined up, and there may be somebody here from the Met Council that can speak more to the details of this, but I believe the grants are already lined up. The question is when the Met Council wants to use this bonding process to smooth out, because the grants will come in at different times, so to smooth out that process, they'll want to issue a short-term bond after they've received the grant. And so it's not so much that the grants aren't lined up, it's more the cost of that short-term financing. And so what Section 6 would do is it would allow the Met Council to use the GANS bonds, which would be a lower cost than the certificates of participation that they would otherwise have to issue if they wanted to do that short-term bonding to smooth out the financing when you're getting a federal grant, which comes at different times.
Madam Chair, and just to follow up on that, as a freshman, and why I believe that we have to be accountable for the state funds, and this would probably be a more proactive and a more efficient way to do this, I too can't support this amendment. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do I understand correctly, if we would tie the hands of the Met Council, they would have to use a different tool that would actually cost more money? Is that correct?
Mr. Clement.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's as I understand the issue, and it's what the MAC Council has told me.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, can't support it. It doesn't make sense for us to be raising, costing taxpayers more money by adding this amendment.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, I'll say that I, too, am not going to support this amendment. It, I think that just increasing public costs for no other purpose than to just be unhappy with the product, I don't think is justifiable at this point. And with that, and Representative Schnauze.
Madam Chair, obviously I didn't bring the amendment for us to bring more cost onto the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. But this is looking at the authority that we give to the Met Council. Now, the Met Council, in a variety of ways, continues to create liabilities for the taxpayers of Minnesota. I have no doubt if this amendment were actually brought forward and the bill was amended and we didn't make the amendment to current law that the bill provides, that the Met Council would probably exercise, you know, the more expensive ways of funding what they want to fund, because that's how they tend to operate. With that, Madam Chair, I withdraw the amendment.
The A14 amendment is withdrawn. Next, I have an A15 amendment. We're just taking them in the order in which we received these. This is another Druskowski amendment. Representative Hertas.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment with regard to the A14 and give some context to how this really transpired. You might remember, members, that the Met Council, despite the fact that they did not have a full funding grant agreement in place with regard to establishing and building out the Southwest Light Rail project, they had gone ahead without that anyway and were spending the taxpayers' money and had already ordered cars for this new line, which are not interchangeable with the other light rail lines. It's a new generation of rail car. And so the frustration was that the legislature felt it was fiscally responsible to limit the authority of the Met Council to not be expanding this until this federal question had been resolved. In 2017, there was a need to replace the bus service. There was concern that the bonding authority, if granted without restrictions, was going to allow the Met Council to circumvent the legislature's will by going ahead and do further expenditures without that full funding grant agreement being in place. So what happened was probably those who don't support the light rail's worst fear is that they dissolved CTIB and went ahead and have circumvented the legislature. So that's kind of a history of what had happened, and thank you, Representative Druskowski, for inviting the discussion, and also thank you for withdrawing the amendment, because circumstances as they are right now, the cost would be higher to build it and is not in the taxpayers' best interest.
All right. Representative Druskowski, would you like to move your A15 amendment and tell us about it?
I would, Madam Chair. I move the A15 amendment. Madam Chair, members, the A15 amendment removes Article 5, Section 7 from the bill, which extends the ability for small townships, I believe under a population of 10,000, if Mr. Clayman could correct me if I'm wrong on that. Townships under 10,000 gives them the ability to bond. And I don't know what the origin of this language that's in the bill is. Ostensibly, it was brought by the department. But members, I could remind you that townships meet annually every year, where every person in the township is invited to attend, and many of them do. And if they want the ability to bond as a township, they can do that at the annual meeting. They don't need to have this special authority between annual meetings that this language that's in the bill provides. So that's the rationale for the amendment, Madam Chair, and I'd be interested in any commentary that Mr. Clayman may have.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, this is actually a part of the public finance bill that we heard on one of our last hearings. It did not come from the Department of Revenue, just to be clear. And Mr. Klayman, it's been referenced that maybe you could help us understand this. And so while he's getting that, we'll wait a minute.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, so what Section 7 of the public finance article does is it essentially what it does by striking that reference to municipality. What it would do is it would allow municipalities to use, well, I guess, so municipality is referenced as a town as described in Section 368, and that actually provides a definition of a town, and that does not include a town that is below a certain population threshold. So currently, the capital improvement bonds would not be able to be issued by towns that have a population lower than what is in the definition. And Madam Chair, my colleague, Mr. Swanson, just found that citation, and it's 1,000 is what the current population threshold is. So what this provision would do is that a town then that has a population of less than 1,000 could issue capital improvement bonds. To do that, the bonds would have, or the project would have to be part of their capital improvement project. There'd have to be a public hearing, but there would not be a referendum that would then be required for the town board to issue those bonds under the current capital improvement bond statute.
So, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Klayman. It was 1,000, not 10,000. I had 10,000 on the mind for some reason. So, Mr. Klayman, if this section is not in the bill, if this amendment would be successful in striking this section from the bill, would then a township less than 1,000 people have the ability to do bonding if that decision was arrived at an annual meeting?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, unfortunately, off the top of my head, I'm not sure what the bonding authority would be for those towns who have less than 1,000. If they did have that authority, presumably they have to hold a referendum, which they then could do through, say, a town meeting, or but Ms. Dalton may have further information about the bonding authority for towns of less than 1,000.
Ms. Madam Dalton? Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, you're correct. A town, because everybody who appears at a town meeting gets to vote, that would essentially count as a referendum, so they could issue a bond based on a vote at a town meeting.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I encourage your support.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask, some of our small towns are struggling to pay for basic services. Does this provision help those townships cover those sorts of things?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, we were actually just going, wow, what a good question. I don't know if this has any impact on the interest rate issue. I mean, the reality is small towns don't bond very often just because they are so small and their tax base is so low. It's hard for them to issue bonds that they can repay in kind of a standard 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I have to admit I am not as big an expert on towns as I wish I was.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So again, listening to the testimony and what I have kind of read through in terms of what this would do is creating a lot more questions than answers. So I think at this time, while it's a simple amendment, I can't support it.
Representative Runda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support the amendment. I mean, we've heard over the years stories of countless small towns that have gotten in over their heads, taken on risk that they can't afford This just gives them more opportunity and more of a green light to make, you know, decisions that they really can't possibly fund on their you know, on their own. So I don't think we should be encouraging it, and they should be looking, you know, to other sources. If they've got infrastructure issues, they should be coming to the PFA. They should be doing other things other than this.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, let me just remind members again, if they can bond at the town meeting, which is once a year in March, they come together in the town hall or wherever, they can make the decision to exercise their bonding authority then under current law without this section in the bill. If the section in the bill goes away, they'll have the ability to do it then. Putting this section in the bill takes away the authority of the people at the town meeting and gives it to the officers of the township board between March of 1 year and March of the next year when they meet again, and they'd have that same ability to exercise that same decision making. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Jaskowski, or Representative Jaskowski, and members, I'm concerned that when you would use this, and we've heard that small towns don't bond very often because it's expensive and it's a lot of work, quite honestly. But I'm thinking of the emergency circumstance where you have a tornado that wipes out the town. It's hard to have a town meeting when people have scattered hither and yon. And, you know, they may need to respond to some emergency needs in a unique way. We do have this authority, as I understand it, for cities that are under 1,000. And I guess I would trust the township boards to make that decision about when they need to have a full town meeting. They may not even have a place to have a town meeting in the case of a natural disaster. And so I don't know why we wouldn't allow them that same flexibility that we allow for small cities. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see in the language that it would restrict it to a natural disaster or some type of an emergency. Am I not seeing that correctly?
Representative Hertas, my sense is that if it's something planful, it's in their long-range improvement plan, they would bring it to the town meeting. That's a typical topic of discussion, but that in the unexpected, unfortunately, happens in our climate a little too regularly. Representative Jaskowski.
Madam Chair, I just point out that small cities don't have township meetings. So they don't have an annual meeting where everybody in the township is able to come together and make a collective decision like townships do. So there's a huge difference between the two. And once every single year, they have the ability to do that and exercise that. So, you know, we're taking the language in the bill, takes that authority from all of the members of the township to all the citizens of the township, and gives the ability for those township officers to make that decision without them. And, you know, a year, once a year, every year they meet.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay?
No.
Nay.
No.
Motion is defeated. Next, we have an A11 amendment from Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A11 amendment. The A11 amendment, members, deals with, I think this is a department initiative, and I don't know, Madam Chair, that we've had enough discussion on this topic, but the department is bringing forward some new computer software in their PRISM system, and it's impinging upon rural electric co-ops. And so what this amendment would do is take out that language that affects those rural electric co-ops. I have heard from a number of mine that they're going to have to go out and count and inventory and appraise every pole that they have on their distribution system if this language goes through. That's expensive. It's onerous. I also have, Madam Chair, a handout that I'll hand around, which is an email from the department to a particular township. I've redacted the specifics in here, but it basically is a directive to the co-op and saying, you will do this, and this is how you're going to operate. Yeah, I'll hand it to Paige here. And so that part is troubling. I don't know, and as I've talked to people, my understanding is that the department has not had a sit-down with the co-ops to talk to them about this and what it means to them and what they're asking for, or not what they're asking for, what they're directing, using the power of government to tell the rural electric co-ops what they have to do. And this is going to be very expensive for them. The department doesn't seem to care. This is the amendment to pull the language from the bill, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I think some of our members don't have this amendment in their packet.
Oh. Is it coming out right now? The A11 is the amendment under discussion.
Yeah. There's at least three of us do not have it.
Okay. The page is checking. It was okay. The page is going to hand it out now. A11. Does everyone else have it? If you don't, raise your hand and the page will make sure you got it. They've been managing a paper blizzard here today on since it only had this morning before we convened to try and get it all organized. So we appreciate their work. Now, if everyone has it, Representative Zhang had a question or comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think when I was on Maplewood City Council, we had a presentation on...
Speak to the mic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think when I was on the Maplewood City Council, we had a presentation on the prison system a while back. Do we have someone from Department of Revenue to explain the prison system for us?
Is there someone from the Department of Revenue who is here who could explain the PRISM system and how this would impact it? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the record and help us understand the impact of this proposed amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Andrea Fish, and I'm here with the Department of Revenue. The sections in the bill proposed to be removed by the amendment relate to the Property Records Information System of Minnesota, or PRISM, and that is a reporting requirement for how counties are to report property tax assessment, valuation, classification, and tax data to the state. And there is not a direct implication or requirement for rural electric co-ops in those sections. It's just what the counties are required to provide to us.
Representative Duszkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just maybe share a copy of this memo with Ms. Fish, because this is what the department is telling the rural electric co-ops. It says, provide the following documentation. Doesn't ask. It says, provide the following documentation. Rural Utility Services annual report or audited financial statements, general ledgers for all operating property, verification of the amounts of distribution lines located outside of city limits. So this is the issue that they're having, and I am told that it relates directly to the PRISM initiative. So can you comment on that?
Ms. Fish.
Madam Chair, Representative Duszkowski, I will do my best. Those reporting requirements are not PRISM reporting requirements. There might be some relation as counties are getting more particular, more discrete property tax data, and many of them have discussed being able to clean up their CAMA, their assessment and tax systems. So there might be a correlation there, but not necessarily a causation. And again, the PRISM reporting requirements don't directly impact the rural electric co-ops.
Representative Duszkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Fish, can you tell me why Damaris Ledesma, the revenue tax specialist from the property tax division in the department, sent an email to one of the rural electric co-ops that said, we need verification of the amount of distribution lines located outside of the city limits. This is a department asking for this. It's not a county. And I don't know who this person is, but obviously they work for you, and this is coming from the department.
Ms. Fitch, and I see you have a friend.
Yes, I'm going to phone
who
a
might offer some additional information. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm staff attorney with the Department of Revenue. And Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, as to your question, co-ops, among other property taxpayers, ones that are subject to state assessed property valuation, report information directly to the department related to their property records for purposes of the department performing evaluation. That's a different process. That's a different process in the stage than what the language in the bill that's in there related to the PRISM system. So the information related to the PRISM system is how the county reports information to the department. The information that's being requested and what you distributed to the committee is what the department asks companies for directly for purposes of performing the valuation. So it relates to different sets of statute where the department has the authority to request certain data from companies for valuations versus the PRISM-related information that's submitted by counties to the department.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. I think we're getting somewhere. So it sounds like, and by the way, again, they weren't asked. They were told by the department that you have to give us this stuff. And so that's where the heartburn, the problem is happening for the electric co-ops. And it sounds like my amendment might be off target, and I accept that, and I understand that. And I'm wondering, Mr. Gustafson, as this bill moves forward, if you can help me find where in statute we need to have this discussion, maybe with Representative Marquardt as it gets to his committee, because I know Representative Marquardt is concerned with his co-ops. I am. Every rural member here is. And then I would, and I see you nodding yes, so thank you. But I would also ask where in the department did this language and this directive to the co-ops come from? Can you share with us what the origin of this is and why?
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, not sure if I can provide the full history or explanation of it. It's part of the annual request for information from the companies that the department values. I think that's about all the depth of explanation I can provide. I do want to add, though, that the department has met with representatives from various co-ops, and we have committed to them that we'll continue to provide assistance to work with them in providing information in a way that does not impose an unnecessary burden on them, and we'd be happy to continue the discussion with you and the co-ops as well.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gustafson, and I'll look forward to meeting with you. Thanks.
Representative Marquardt.
So, well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski. I did, at a township meeting, I had someone from the co-ops approach me on this, and then I hadn't really heard anything else. But if you'd be willing to withdraw that amendment, I think we need to look at this. I don't know if it's related to PRISM. I see in this memo it's, you know, Rules 8100, which is, you know, kind of the crux of what's going on right now with all the statewide valuations of utilities and other things. So if you'd be willing to withdraw the amendment, we could take a look at this before the tax committee finalizes its bill, if that'd be all right, Representative Drazkowski.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Marquardt. I will do just that. I'll withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
The A11 amendment is withdrawn. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Marquardt and Drazkowski. With state-assessed property, I suspect that the issue is how you assess property. There's three approaches: the market approach, the cost approach, and the income approach. So I think the questions with regard to the memo here relate to the income approach.
Thank you. The next amendment I have is the A6 from Representative Drazkowski, although this was incorporated into the author's amendment. So we won't offer it at this point. I see a signal from Representative Drazkowski. Next, we have an A12 from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill, this amendment deals with not a often used a program called Senior Deferral. And thank you, Madam Chair, for including the change in date for that in the current bill and the amendment, because that really helps for those that are finding time restraints in getting it submitted. But this amendment does two things. The first section really talks about situations in which, and to give a little background about the senior deferral, when people that qualify that are senior citizens, they have their home already paid for, they're on low income, and all of a sudden they're getting their property tax bill in front of them. For some of them, that puts them in a dire straits, and they just can't afford to stay in their house and pay the taxes. The program allows the state to go and pay the tax for them as a loan, and then when they sell the property or they die, that exclusion then dissipates, and the proceeds from the sale pay off the loan to the state. So it's a really good benefit for those that use it. There are a couple of circumstances that are happening every once in a while, and this amendment deals with that. The first is if you don't have your taxes paid off, you can't give a clean title, and if you can't give a clean title, it's very difficult to sell property, so they're kind of stuck between what I would say is a rock and a hard place here. And so this just first section says on 1.21 and 1.22 that a confession of judgment under Section 27937 stating that delinquent taxes are being paid by the senior citizens deferral qualifies as cleaning up that title. That's the first part. The second part is just in the application process itself. Some senior citizens apply and get information to the application, and then there's a determination that one piece of it is missing or something is missing, and they're denied their application. The second part actually just gives them the authority to resubmit that information with missing information in it, and allows them to still qualify during that same time frame without having to wait another year and losing another year's worth of property tax deferral. So that's it in a nutshell, and I do ask you for your support.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I'd like to know more about this program. It's only for seniors, is that right?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, at this point it is called the Senior Deferral Program.
And Madam Chair, Representative
Hewitt.
Is there, does it continue if they continuously cannot pay their taxes? Do we continue to build up the years then, or?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it would continue, but they would need to apply each year.
Okay. Madam Chair, House Research, is there any fiscal note or anything in this, or?
Michelle?
Madam Chair and Representative Hewitt, this was a bill last year, and I have a revenue estimate from that bill. It says the following: in the case of the incomplete application, the proposal would give the applicant 60 days from the date of receipt. So this, what's being proposed is a little bit different, offering 90 days, but there would be a negligible cost. In addition, I have a summary from the Department of Revenue on the program in general. Basically, beginning in 1999, this voluntary program allows a senior citizen to postpone paying their portion of the homestead property taxes and special assessments. The state reimburses counties for the amount of property taxes deferred each year. A homestead may remain eligible until a qualifying homeowner no longer lives in the property, at which point the deferred taxes and interest must be paid to the state. Qualified homeowners must be age 65 or older, who have owned and lived in their home for at least 15 years and have house income of less than $60,000. They can postpone the portion of the taxes above 3% of their income, and I have statistics if you care for more information. But this has been a program around for about 20 years. I would say low participation, although it has stepped up in the last 4 or 5 years. And right now, according to the revenue estimate, at least this portion that is being proposed has a negligible impact, actually in the tail, so it would happen after fiscal 21.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Petersburg, have you worked with the Department of Revenue on the change of dates here to see if it's feasible? I know elsewhere in the bill we are at their suggestion adding a later date in the year that by which seniors could apply for this program, and you know, the extra 90 days. I'm just not sure if you've had a chance to confer with them yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know Jared Swanson has had a lot of discussions with them, and we are still waiting for some final comments from them. But going from 60 to 90 days, if that's a change that needs to be happened, I certainly can make that change as well. So it's not 90, but the question is we need to give senior citizens, which have oftentimes in low income situations, may not have access to other legal forms and other things to help them with this. It just seems like giving them a little extra time to be able to get everything done is valuable to them. And I don't know if Mr. Swanson has more comment.
Mr. Swanson?
Madam Chair, members, as Representative Petersburg said, we did reach out to the department for some feedback on the language, and we're still kind of waiting for their final feedback.
Members, I think this is a good program, and I know what you're doing. Representative Petersburg is trying to make it even more pro-consumer. I'm willing to accept this going on to the bill as long as you're willing to keep working on it so that before we go to the full tax committee, we really have the insights on the practical impacts of this on just administering the program.
I have no problem with that, Madam Chair.
Right. And Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you characterized in your statement that this was an extra 90 days. It's an extra 30 days. It's just 30 days more than the 60 that is right. Current.
Thank you.
That's
thank you, Madam Chair.
Point well made. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A-12 is adopted. Next, I have an A-13 from Representative Petersburg.
Madam Chair, that was just the last half of A-12. In case the full thing didn't go on, I will draw that one.
Okay. Thank you. The next amendment I have is an A-17, and I don't have a name associated with that. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A-17 amendment. Members, the A-17 amendment relates to the language on page 54 of the DE amendment. After line 3 would insert, notwithstanding, an owner or manager agent is not required to provide the data elements in paragraph A if the equivalent data is available from another public accessible source, including Census Bureau data. The point of this amendment is to reduce redundancy when this information is already available.
Discussion. I'm just looking up the situation here. Oh, this is the report on the rent credit report. Representative Hertas, my question is that this is to fill out the certificate of rent paid, which is part of our property tax refund program for renters. And so they're still going to have to provide information in order to calculate that for each of their tenants. And I'm just wondering if the way this is written, whether it would in any way interfere with that?
Well, Madam Chair, the renter's credit is really based on income and percent of the rent paid. So that is, under the current program, is paid with or without this data, and even with the data wouldn't make any difference in terms of the qualification for the renter's credit that is paid. And as most in this committee know, the renter's credit is phased out with enough income, so or significantly reduced with income. So this collection of data doesn't change, in fact, somewhat encumbers the efficiency of an automated system where basically landlords are reporting the rent paid, and that is able to be matched up with the income and application by renters. So I don't see that the data really provides anything.
At this point, I'd be willing to accept this, but we'll, before it goes to the full taxes, better understand it with the Department of Revenue and looking into the data sources that you've noted, because my understanding of those data sources is they're not as comprehensive geographically or in real time. So, but that will give us a chance to look at that. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, yeah, if this kind of messes with the CRP program, then I can't support it, but if there's an opportunity to get more information, I think that would be helpful. But right now, that would be, it causes me some concerns.
Representative Bernardi.
I was just wondering, how does this data affect the how would this data affect the CRP as it stands now?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, so if you look at page 53 and 54 of the DE amendment, that's sort of the base document for the division report, sort of the process governing how certificates of rent paid will be gathered through this automated system is kind of coded in paragraph D of subdivision 1. And then there's sort of a separate language in subdivision 2 governing the collection of rental market information. And so the amendment is adding a new paragraph D to only the subdivision governing rental market information. So it shouldn't affect the sort of normal process of distributing certificates of rent paid for the purposes of just administering the program. It would only sort of affect the rental market information subdivision.
Representative Bernardi? That's it. Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay? The amendment is adopted, A-17. And I have an A-18.
Madam Chair, having accepted the A-17 amendment, I'll withdraw the A-18 amendment.
All right. All good. I can't find that. And that is the last amendment that I have in my packet. Are there other amendments that members would want to have considered? I see none. Now is our opportunity for a general discussion on the proposal before us. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have spoken before about the household income and the property tax refund program, and I wondered if you could give us your rationale for raising the household income eligibility for that program to $155,000. It seems very generous when there are certainly households getting by on $24,000 a year, which is kind of a standard single person senior living in their home. Was there discussion about boosting the refund for those households? I mean, because I don't understand. I'd love to hear the rationale.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. We know that we don't have one economy in our state of Minnesota, and that the value of houses and the varies dramatically across our state, and the income that's required to secure housing varies dramatically across our state. and this was an attempt to recognize that, particularly for people who live in some of the expensive exurban areas, while giving them just a minor benefit. The program is still very progressive and dedicates most of the resources to the much more modest income households you were talking about. But we felt that, you know, people are struggling in our more expensive communities to meet the basics, and we thought that they'd appreciate some recognition of the rising property taxes within their communities.
Madam Chair, was there any discussion to put whatever those dollars are? Do we know what the dollars are for that new increment you're adding, the $105,000, which the current cap?
Yeah.
How much is that going to spend?
Ms. Schill?
Madam Chair, Representative Rumbeck, it is on the spreadsheet that I reviewed, and it's actually line 10 of the first page of the spreadsheet. The cost for increasing the income eligibility to $155,000 and change is $22.5 million in fiscal 21, and then in fiscal 22-23, it totals $53.7 million, so it grows slightly.
And, Madam Chair, do we know the number of households that we anticipate?
Excuse me. That number actually includes all of the changes in the homestead credit, including increasing the maximum for across the lower incomes as well. I think Mr. Williams may have the more broken down analysis.
Madam Chair and Representative Rumbeck, I believe the number was 11.5 for the expansion of the eligibility, but the bill additionally increases the homeowner maximums. So a portion of that 22.5 that Ms. Schill referenced, I think, is the increase in the homeowner maximums. So the bill is sort of, there's two parts.
Mm-hmm. Well, Representative, Madam Chair, if I could, for some of those at the very top, the refund, it's almost as much as what you would pay a CPA to fill out the form. You know, I mean, it is so insignificant as to be not worth the time and the effort that we're putting into it. I mean, I frankly can't buy it because, you know, we there's such limited dollars. I mean, this is becoming a giveaway program. I don't understand why we're doing it. It seems to me it's a bit of pandering to the middle class, the middle income voter. Get them on the hook, get them dependent on some kind of a government program. You know, without demonstrating further the need, you know, which they really don't do, I think, as they're applying for this program. I just very, very concerned about it.
Thank you. And I don't know of anyone who needs a CPA to fill out the property tax refund program. It's a pretty simple form. But Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And, you know, with the projections, property taxes this year are going to go over $10 billion statewide, which has never occurred ever in our state history. And what this does is to try to say that if your property taxes are high in comparison to your income, we're going to provide a relief. And Minnesota's always had a pretty robust program. And when you look at kind of total factors of that, and the Voss report comes out every year that kind of looks at all of that, it does help equalize and bring down property taxes for a lot of folks. But you have a number of senior citizens, for example, especially in the metro area, who might have bought homes at $50,000 or $60,000 back 40 years ago that now are in the 300s or more. And the one thing that this, on the Homestead Credit State Refund, the difference or the new language is just increasing the maximum. So one thing the Bosch report showed is that a lot of people still are paying more than 5 or 6% of their income in property taxes. And those are the folks that are maximizing, getting to the maximum. And these are a lot of these senior citizens that I've just talked about. They're in these homes. But also folks that are in this income range from $115,000 to $155,000 that we're looking at to provide a modest relief here at that point. But I think it's important for the state to look at where you have. So you've got kind of two programs. Let me back up a step. So this, your bill, Madam Chair, provides significant increases in local government aid and county program aid. And what local government aid has done is it tends to equalize property values, tax bases. And so basically saying that if you live in community X, that you should be able to get the same level of law enforcement, public safety at roughly the same cost as somebody in a wealthier district, for example. But that's kind of one layer. Then you get another layer where you still have where, even though the tax base has kind of been equalized, get to a point where, according to individual property taxpayers, you get people are still paying very high in comparison to their income. And so the two kind of work in tandem. And so, you know, I think between the renter's credit and the homestead credit state refund, you're going to have 466,000 people who are going to see property tax cuts through increased refunds in either the homeowners or renters refund, which I think is significant. And it's something the state can do in providing direct relief to homeowners, which is going to be about $45 million this year, and about $110,000 to homeowners and about $356,000 renters are going to see benefits here. And I think, so, you know, we're extending it into a little higher income on the homeowners, which I think matches more of kind of where we're going right now. Just in, you know, that's been set at around $100,000 and, you know, incomes increase and so forth. But you also have folks in the suburban, exurban areas who are, you know, kind of not addressed in that formula that I think it's important that we do that there. So where the local government aid, about 65% of those new dollars go to rural Minnesota. It's kind of flip-flops when you do the homestead credit state refund and renters program. So they kind of go tandem and they work a good balance in providing overall tax relief. So I think it's a good program. I know on the homestead credit state refund, you're not messing with any of the threshold amounts. The only thing is you're increasing the maximums to get those people who are still seeing a high amount of their taxes as compared to their income. That's creating this extra burden. So it's really in response to that Voss report that comes out every year that still shows a number of people with high taxes in comparison to their income.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of comments. One is that I really appreciate your earlier amendment to that pretty much reinstated all of the local option sales tax and others that in which local taxpayers had input into really taking and keeping control over their own areas. So I think that was very valuable, and I thank you for that. The other is just to reiterate the school building bond agriculture credit moving from 40 to 70%, I think will have a major impact. I have a school district in my own district that is going for a major bond referendum, and I think this will be helpful because we have a lot of old buildings in our school systems that really need to be updated, and we need to help wherever we can to reduce barriers in order to getting that done. So I thank you for that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi.
Well, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for including the property tax refund for manufactured home cooperatives. These are people that are really being empowered and taking control of their property and investing in the infrastructure. And it's really the affordable housing. And these co-ops are stabilizing their housing so it doesn't get sold off for a developer for a higher bid and a higher profit for the people who own the park. And so we have a cooperative in our district, and I know they're very grateful for this. So they now are going to be able to get property tax refund where they hadn't been before, and it's a small group of people, but it's people that are really going to benefit greatly by this. And I'm glad that you included this, and I just want to thank you very much for that.
And Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank you for working together on much of what we've come together, both sides of the aisle, in terms of coming up with a division report. But I'm a little frustrated with how this session played out so far with regard to this committee and our ability to get together, schedule interruptions, and maybe not hearing the numbers of bills that we've been able to hear in the past. It seems like we spent an inordinate amount of time on overviews and department concerns, agency concerns. One of the challenging topics for those who haven't served on this committee before is the ever-complicated property tax system. Our perennial effort to work towards class and rate compression and to make the system more just and more fair for all property taxpayers. I'll remind members that over many decades, the legislature and perhaps this committee has been subjected to cries and appeals about property taxes in Minnesota, and it's been easy to do carve-outs and create a complicated system. It's much easier to do that than it is to actually reform the system, and so we have the mess that we have. Representative Bernardi, the co-ops and renters credit, I support that. I also introduced a bill that basically would have compressed that affordable housing component for those folks that live in manufactured home parks. There's simply no reason they should be paying somewhat of a commercial rate, if you will, for property taxes. We could better address lowering the cost to those low-income earners who reside in those mobile home parks by reducing the tax rates to a rate that is competitive with residential rates that other people pay. Members, we're having 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every day in this country. And increasingly, not just me, but I'm sure you are too, you're getting email messages from seniors who have lived in their property some length of time and have seen their values triple or quadruple while they have lived in their property. And many of the emails that I've been getting have been from areas that are so-called perceived wealthy districts where these folks are really having to contemplate selling their home and moving, which is not something we ever imagined. I oftentimes reflect on the beginning of my building career where I started building homes in Plymouth on a city lot with sewer and water, curb and gutter, all of the amenities in so-called wealthy community. And those homes were $86,900 complete. Now, I realize I'm talking about a few decades ago, but nonetheless, that same house is four and five times the value. And you heard me mention there's three ways to value property. Well, income approach really doesn't work for valuing residential property, that which we all live in. The cost approach didn't work very well during the Great Housing Recession because it cost more than the market was to build a home. And so that's why we weren't building houses. You couldn't get a comparable to support the price. And so getting a mortgage was very difficult. There was a time that I thought that this was going to be a great opportunity for affordable housing as people were gravitating from rural areas to the metro area for the jobs and the opportunities and everything that the city has to offer. I thought there was going to be a renaissance in rural areas, that people would move to smaller towns and be able to have affordable housing and find or seek employment in some of these regional areas. That hasn't happened. And as people continue to gravitate towards the center of the city, we see the market approach continue to drive and fuel the prices of homes, that there is such a disparity for the same standard of living, the same square feet, the same style of house, if it exists in Plymouth or it exists in Morris, Minnesota, or it exists in Fargo or Moorhead area. And so when we talk about property tax burden with regard to household income, this is becoming a real serious issue that seniors are looking for some type of relief. and we're not addressing the problem. Representative Marquardt, you and I have worked together a long time on this committee, and I've agreed with you that property taxes are regressive. You've made that argument frequently. With regard to the LGA formula, supposedly that is supposed to give some relief for the regressiveness of property taxes, and you just stated so. But given the dynamics of what's been going on in terms of the migration of people towards urban centers, that small towns aren't really growing, regional centers might, but small towns are struggling. And right here in Hennepin County, we've got communities that operate on very thin, lean, mean, and reserved budgets, in contrast with communities around greater Minnesota that have the same population and have 50, 60, 70% of their annual operating general fund budget are subsidized by state or by the local government aid program. In this bill, I notice that we have used the LGA program to give special preference again to a handful of communities, using about $6 million of local government aid increase to favor some of these communities that have and continue to be on the local government aid formula program. So with that, Chair Marquardt, I will continue to work with you with regard to LGA reform. I put forth a good bill that addresses this issue. I have continued to compile more data that makes my argument more compelling about what is wrong with the LGA formula, and I will share that with you. And I did not bring forth House File 2031 as an amendment in this committee because I intend to still work with you during the remainder of this session that we can actually get some reform. So I look forward to meeting with you again and working on that. I want to have more information, more data I want to share with you. And I think that's something in the final omnibus tax bill that we need to really review. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2348, as amended, is adopted and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion passes. Representative Jessikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment, too. I just appreciate your leadership on the committee. Thank you for being open to discussing items, you know, very communicative, I think, with the minority, at least with me. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate you putting in some of the provisions that I had and having discussion about things that were certainly non-controversial, but made sense for Minnesota, and you did that a number of times, so I appreciate that. Appreciate you putting in the Representative Marquardt's proposal for the school bond payment increase. Of course, I struggle with the LGA and CPA increases, but you and the majority are going to have to make some decisions as you go down the road here. Certainly, the taxes that the majority is looking forward to or hoping happen and materialize are not going to happen at the level, or maybe hopefully not at all, but are not going to certainly happen at the level that funds the level that's in here. So you're going to have some choices to make, and I hope that you value that school bond piece going forward for some of the additional spending that you do down the road. But just again, thank you for your candor and your leadership on the committee. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank all the members for their contributions and for your patience as a new chair and as a committee that only meets once a week and lost 20% of its meetings to Monday holidays. I still love Monday holidays, but it did make our work more difficult. We had to add on some evenings. As Representative Hertas noted, there are many issues that we did not get to, and we intentionally decided we had to cut it somewhere. And so next year we expect to be dealing with many of the issues that you pointed out in terms of classifications and administrative issues and things that didn't have a direct impact on the state budget that we are allowed. But I think in the end we've ended up with a bill that will benefit people in all communities. Everyone benefits from the increases in county program aid. The local government aid program does help a lot of communities with their needs. The pension aid that we put in benefits absolutely every public taxing jurisdiction across the state. And we know that renters and homeowners in every part of the state will benefit from the increases with that. But I do want to particularly thank my leads, Representative Hertas and Representative Druskowski. You've always been open. I tried to, on Thursdays before our Friday meeting, check in with you, learn about your concerns, what your priorities were. You were really gracious in getting your members to move along some of our intense committee meetings when we had a lot of guests from across the state so that everyone was heard before they had to drive home, and I know they appreciated that as well. So thank you. Thank you very much. I also want to thank the staff that make this all possible. And we have Ellen Larson, who stepped up to a new role as their committee legislative assistant and kept everything organized, including the paper blizzard today. And Nathan Jessen, who is our new committee administrator, has proven to be a reliable and useful source, not just to the Democrats on the committee, but to everyone. And his knowledge and insights are really valuable. The nonpartisan staff in House Research and Fiscal Analysis are the brains of the operation, and we know we have the A-team, although probably everyone who works with those departments thinks they have the A-team. And they're always willing to clarify and clearly explain the law. They did that multiple times on amendments today, and they always step up with a smile to help us achieve our dreams as we talk to them about our ideas. And so they're all stars in alphabetical order. Thank you, Pat Dalton, Alex Hagler, Chris Clayman, Kathy Schill, Jared Swanson, and Sean Williams. You are all stars, and we really appreciate your work. Our partisan researchers help brief the members on all the complexity we're dealing with and help facilitate the development of proposals. And so I'd like to thank Sean Haydorn from the DFL Caucus and Stephen Rupus on behalf of the Republican Caucus. And our pages, oh my gosh, whether it's handing around treats, scrambling to find that missing amendment, and or passing a note or grabbing a member to get out of the room in time to vote in another committee, they've always stepped up with a smile and kept us organized. And thank you so much, Steve and Ben, for your service. And thanks, finally, to the Department of Revenue staff and many of the people here in the audience today are watching, because you all play an important role in helping us shape public policy. You're also a part of our faculty and part of our advisory team, and we know that the bill before us reflects much of your input and work as well. And I have one final announcement. We may have one more combined meeting with the full tax committee, because the K-12 finance bill has some school equalization issues and some things that will impact property taxes of school districts, and that will likely be next week, so we'll send out a notice about when that is. And if you're not able to make it, people understand, but we do want to have the property tax division have a chance to join Representative Marquardt's committee in being briefed on that. Representative Hertas.
Oh, I was making a hand signal to one of our staff members, but I neglected to also thank the staff. I want to say the same thing, and you certainly did a great job of filling in a long-standing institutional knowledge of Joel Michaels and Mr. Hines, and I think you did a great job. Thank you.
Great. And with that, the Property Tax Division is adjourned. Thank you.